Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patty LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
All right. I'm going to start with a story, not to ruin the ending, but the ending of this story is my parents were freaking amazing. It's like my, I don't know, it was one of my teenage birthdays. I'm going to say like 16, 17. I wake up on my birthday. I go upstairs, you know, because my room's in the basement. Basements, by the way, so cool. I miss basements living in California.
Yeah.
I come up from the basement. My birthday cake is on the table. Soup's cute. And on that birthday cake is the double disc cast album of Sunset Boulevard.
Oh my God. Like as a decoration?
Like as a decoration. Like it's standing up straight, like in the frosting. They went to like Hastings Books and bought the double disc, which is, you know, is fat. It's not just your normal CD jewel.
Yeah. Oh no, fat. The double disc. With the thing in the middle that you have to crack open if you're opening the side that has Act One and the libretto or the side that just has Act Two.
Absolutely. Thank you.
It's a very specific, that sound, if I could bottle that sound as a memory of that pop of a double disc cast recording.
Ooh. So good.
Which leads us to, of course, isn't it weird that why did Into the Woods have a double disc thing because they only had one disc? You know why?
Because the libretto that fat was book. Sick.
Yeah.
Because of all those words.
It had to slap you with
it's
that.
It's the
fat
only
book.
Album I know in history where there are so many words in these songs that in order to print them out, you had to have a book that looked like it was a double cast recording.
Right. But Sondheim tempos are such that it all fit on one disc.
Exactly. This is so true. Okay,
go on. Sorry.
Yeah, so it's sitting there in the frosting. I have a summer birthday, and that is the moment when I fell in love with Sunset Boulevard. I think because even though it's moody and evocative and drama-filled, with maybe a touch of camp, I will always think of my birthday cake.
I love that. Wait, I do have one question. What was
What
was the decor on the rest of the cake? Was it just like a white icing?
It was literally white cake, happy birthday, Jeffrey, Sunset Boulevard.
I love that. I really love that because they were like, you know what? We have the accent at home.
Exactly. Focal point.
Yeah, we don't need your Albertsons birthday balloons. We don't need your like tinted icing. We're going to take white icing and we know what our son needs.
Thank you, Glenn Close.
If they weren't so capable ridiculous. Of actually crafting the staircase into a cake.
I mean, can you know imagine what? the woman working at like Harmon's who decorates cakes and they bring like John Napier's set design is like we're thinking maybe something.
Our poor parents. Just like, we're trying to give them what they want, but it's so specific.
Welcome, everybody, to a musical theater podcast where we discuss the cultural and emotional... What is it? Cultural and emotional impact. Welcome. Welcome, everybody, to a musical theater podcast where we discuss the cultural and emotional impact of some of our favorite musicals in theater history. My name is Jeffrey Scott Parsons, but you know what? You can call me Jeff. Today, we are talking Sunset Boulevard, and my guest is the only person I know who wears caftans more than Norma Desmond. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Ryan O'Connor.
Hello! I'm so happy to be here. I feel like it's, even though it's a podcast, I feel it's important that people know that I'm not just a casual caftan wearer. I have so many that the most soundproof place to record a podcast in my home is in front of a wall of caftans because it's the most fabric sound. And I have my, you can't see it, but my sound barrier on the other side is a giant teal kimono, which I feel Norma would also wear. But that's my thickest piece. It's like my thickest piece of
the
of
kimono
fabric.
has the textural strength.
It does.
That textile.
In the future, Beyonce will be lining all of her recording studios with kimonos once they get the memo.
What's up with the caftans, though? Can you tell me?
Well, caftans are what I consider to be the freedom garment. The thing that people often say is that caftans are flattering on everybody. That's not true. Caftans are equally flattering on nobody. Nobody looks good in a caftan, but everybody looks fabulous.
Oh my gosh, put it on a t-shirt. It's happening. I'm pretty sure that we just found, we have a Tee Public store, and I'm pretty sure that is what's going on one of the
Oh my t-shirts. God, amazing. Great. I'll be the first to buy it. I started wearing them. I was never like a drag queen type, but as a kid, I always gravitated towards my mom's like big flowy skirts that I would always put on. And then also like cover myself in sheets and stuff. There's something about like being covered in lots of fabric, but lightly on your body, which I can get really dramatic about it and talk to you about how my favorite saying in the world is wear the world like a loose garment. I mean, I can really go deep and hippy dippy about what caftans mean to me if we're, but like, and I get
That's
it. I understand why Norma wore, she actually wears more kimonos than caftans, but there's,
okay.
She is a caftan aesthetic for sure.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's a caftan aesthetic. You're exactly right.
Any garment you can wear that the tag says one size fits most, that's my aesthetic.
I appreciate any garment that, because like, yes, the freedom, the breeze, all of that. And also, if you want to do like a dramatic exit, I love a garment where you turn.
Yes.
And it doesn't end, right? Like the swinging
yes.
of the fabric only punctuates.
It's almost like the fabric is applauding you as you exit.
Yeah.
And reminding the audience to do the same.
That's fantastic. Now, I knew you would be a great guest for this, not just because of the caftans, but also because you just love old films. You love all the ladies. You love all the leading ladies. And
I had a podcast for almost 4 years called Lady Watch, which is the only podcast dedicated to celebrating women over the age of Celine Dion. which we did for a long time, and we do like two specials a year now because we still have our following. And Lady Watch is more than a podcast; it's a lifestyle. And we have Google alerts on. I think it's 1,000 women now. Women over 50, character actresses, politicians' wives. Like who?
Can you tell me like who's one of your favorites? That's like no one else's favorite.
Like when Hello Dolly was running on Broadway, we were, of course, always excited to hear about who else could be playing Hello Dolly. But once Donna Murphy came in and she did those Tuesdays, we became obsessed with Tuesday Dollies. And it was always talking about who are the Tuesday Dollies and like Randy Graff, Nancy Opel. Like these are Tuesday Dollies. These are not eight show dollies that are like you want.
No.
Actually, we had said Carolee Carmello was a Tuesday Dolly and then she ended up being the tour dolly, which it's a fine line between Tuesday Dolly and tour dolly. Things like that. I mean,
Look, I would go see Randy Graff Dolly over Bette Midler Dolly.
Same. I went to see Donna Murphy Dolly over Bette Midler Dolly. I was in town and I only had time to see one and I was only going to see Hello Dolly once because I didn't. And I was like, which am I going to see, Donna or Bette? And I was like, you know who I am? I'm the one who goes to see Donna.
You're a Donna boy. I get it.
And I saw Bernadette.
And I appreciate
you. And also, like,
you.
Bette's Dolly, like, I hadn't seen it, but I could see it. You know what I mean? Like, it's, mm-hmm. I knew what it was, which is not, that's not a dig. That's just a, like.
No.
Yeah. And then I watched
it. No, not at all. In fact, if anything, it speaks of her iconicism.
Absolutely.
All that being said, what is your relationship to Sunset Boulevard and or one Norma Desmond?
Well, if you ask me about, like, what's your favorite film, that's a whole conversation that's difficult for me to have. If you ask me about the greatest films of all time, that's a different. I can be a little bit more categorical, and I can tell you that the greatest film of all time is All About Eve, and the second greatest film of all time.
I know what you're going to say.
The second greatest film of all time is Sunset Boulevard.
Ah!
And
it blows my mind that these films were in the same Oscar season.
The same
and they
year.
Both have my two favorite scripts in all of film history.
Uh-huh.
My mind.
They were both shot at the same time. They are both craftsmen? They're crafted. They're crafted.
They're craftsmen. They have that like that California craftsman
look. They're like a California craftsman home. They are built consciously and perfectly one plank of wood at a time. These are not accidentally great films. These are films that started with a great screenplay, with great directors, with great actors, and they at every turn made the choice to make great art, which is amazing because I also think that great art often comes from the miraculous of event. Like some things come together and they're like, yeah, that was supposed to be a total disaster and it came together and was great. That is not the story of Sunset Boulevard or All About Eve. Those were crafted to be fantastic films and they were successfully fantastic films. And that's because everyone involved
which is just as
was
miraculous.
The top of their game. Absolutely. And that is amazing because that's what everyone creating art should always be shooting for, not for, well, we'll just pull it together and it'll be what it'll be. Yes, of course it will. That's the magic. Mm-hmm. But it'll be what it'll be when you're shooting for the moon is going to be better than it'll be what it'll be if you're shooting for, I don't know, what's under the moon?
Russia. I don't know why that came to mind.
Then if you're shooting for Russia, you're right. You're absolutely right. Nailed it. Perfect. And that, see, that's how chess was born.
Which is another episode, y'all. It's interesting, you know, talking more about All About Eve and Sunset Boulevard. In many ways, All About Eve is the Sunset Boulevard of Broadway.
Yeah.
And Sunset Boulevard is the All About Eve of Hollywood, right? They're both commentaries on the culture and lifestyle of what it means to be in the performing arts for a living, along with the consequences of fame.
Yeah.
Sunset Boulevard, however, I think we see more as a drama nowadays, and we see All About Eve as a comedy. But when these two movies came out, which I think was 1949 and 1950, mm-hmm. Sunset Boulevard was a comedy.
Oh, absolutely.
It walked this really fine line of taking down its own industry. Yeah, commenting on the craziness of Hollywood. And, you know, Hollywood tends to be so self-obsessed that everybody was game. So you watch the old film of Sunset Boulevard, and you have Cecil B. DeMille making cameos. And all of these little touches of reality warps the fantasy so that you don't need, it's so meta. You don't know if what you're watching is true or not true or real life or fantasy. It's all just kind of its own thing, and it's a masterpiece.
When I probably first saw both of these films, either like actually sat down and saw them or saw them in the back. I have a mother who is the type to be watching films like this. So I probably saw them peripherally before I ever like watched them. But I think like, okay, I'm 9 years old and it's like late 80s. I'm 9 years old and I see Sunset Boulevard. I see All About Eve. And to me, I don't have the historical knowledge yet. And so I think everything that I see is a period piece. And to realize as you get older, these are not period pieces. Both of these films take place in 1949. And then you're like, oh my God, in 1949, look at 1949 commenting on 1928. That creates a level of sophistication that you have to get through that's like, I don't know, it's like this idea that we are a better society than we were before, and therefore we can comment on that old society by saying, look how far we've come. And then once that exists, within moments, that thing itself is outdated.
Okay, so the musical Sunset Boulevard, as we've been discussing, is based on the Academy Award winning film by Billy Wilder from 1950, is that right?
It was released in 1950, yeah.
And it concerns Norma Desmond, who used to be big. She was a star of the silent film era. Then, of course, once talkies happened and she started growing older, she became what? Irrelevant, which I think is probably the worst thing you can be in Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
So then she holes up in her mansion on Sunset Boulevard, and the plot is about what happens because of that. Now, I can be somewhat of a critic when it comes to turning films into stage musicals, especially ones concerning the world of cinema. It's like, why on earth would you bring something that is so obviously about film to the stage, which is a completely different art form? However, I actually think that Sunset Boulevard is a perfect vehicle for a musical because we're talking about incredibly vibrant characters that have really high stakes. It almost operates like an opera, a gothic opera.
Yeah.
As a film. So to make a musical out of it, I think is actually a really great idea.
Yeah, the film has this incredibly dynamic score and for its time, one of the most like present scores of a lot of films. And I do feel like Andrew Lloyd Webber crafted something that echoes it, that you almost, you're watching the show and you're almost like, is he using the score? It fits so well. And then by adding in all of the operetta stuff, like it being sung, almost entirely sung through in a lot of places, you kind of go, oh, it's unapologetically musical. It's the difference between, you know, Sunset Boulevard as an adaptation of Sunset Boulevard and then Applause, an adaptation of All About Eve, which has some great numbers, is great in theory, but doesn't quite work. It feels like a mockingness almost, as opposed to a genuine, like, you know, and Sunset Boulevard is, to a fault, genuine.
Reverent.
Reverent, yes. 100% reverent. That's the word.
Yeah. And you're right. I both appreciate it, and it's almost like they may have taken it too seriously, at least at the beginning stages in the first London production.
Yeah. And, you know, that's that thing, too, of you wonder if Andrew Lloyd Webber, he's not, it's weird because Andrew Lloyd Webber has created some of the campiest musicals of all time.
Hello, Cats. You're so right. I didn't even think about this.
And yet, I don't ever get the impression that Andrew Lloyd Webber has any desire to make camp.
No.
That's what's sort of like.
No, you're so right. And yet he's like, I know what I'll do. I'll have Joseph's brother sing a country western song.
Right, exactly, exactly. And I do think that that's where, when you get into Sunset Boulevard, the idea of an aging actress emerging from a staircase written through the scope of a straight British musical theater composer in white guy at the end of the 80s, you know, in a time of great opulence in his own career and life. It's like, where's the camp going to like latch onto like a barnacle at the bottom of a ship? Because you can't create camp, and yet everything is there. And yet, oddly, my biggest complaint about Sunset Boulevard in the end is that it almost isn't campy enough. And this is not, this is being nitpicky about a musical that I really do love. I really do think it's really
wonderful.
Yeah,
I love it too. I love this musical, and every time I see it, I'm a little bored.
Yeah, it's sort of, it just, every time I consume it again in whatever form, if I listen to it or I watch it or whatever, each time I notice another missed opportunity.
Yeah, I get that. Now, after Hal Prince and Andrew Lloyd Webber worked on Evita in the late 70s, Hal Prince wanted to work on something else. And so he pitched Andrew Lloyd Webber the idea of turning Sunset Boulevard into a musical. And the direction that he wanted to go in was to take it out of the silent film into the talkie era and instead redo it so that it was more about a Doris Day type actor. Doris Day, you know, America's sweetheart, huge, huge film star. And then at some point she just decided she wanted nothing more to do with it and really just kind of kept to herself and her animals. The project gets shelved really until after Phantom of the Opera, when Andrew Lloyd Webber remembers this pitch that Hal Prince had given him, and he goes forward with the project. But instead of partnering with Hal, he partners with Trevor Nunn, who, of course, had done Les Mis and Cats. And he gets to write the lyrics. Don Black, who had done Song and Dance, he did, you know, the lyrics for Unexpected Song, which is a very famous Andrew Lloyd Webber song. And they also get Christopher Hampton to co-write the lyrics and book. Christopher Hampton, known probably best for the play and film Les Liaisons Dangereuses. I think I'm saying that right. For those who grew up in the 90s, you know it as Cruel Intentions.
Yeah, exactly. And it is worth noting, like, I don't always try to be this guy because it's not helpful, but it is worth noting that everyone you just mentioned on this creative team is a straight white man.
And oh, for sure.
Also a straight white British man, everyone in that.
Yeah.
Oh, is Trevor Nunn straight? I think he is.
I'm pretty sure.
That doesn't matter. But
I don't know. I don't know his life.
Yeah, exactly. But the point is that you do have a recipe for, you know, a bunch of heterosexual commentary on something that is, at this point in 1989, embraced, Norma Desmond is embraced as a gay icon. So, you know.
You're so true. You're so right.
And you feel it when you're consuming this version of Sunset Boulevard, that does not feel crafted with a gay eye. I'm not saying that it's a good thing or a bad thing, except that I do think it explains a lot of what I feel is missing. And the first big thing that you have to unpack when unpacking Sunset Boulevard is, of course, the Patti LuPone, Glenn Close, Sunset Boulevards. Like, you have these two things that came up at the same time. And with all the drama around it, basically two women are creating their own version of the same role at the same time. So it comes down to, like, was there a conversation happening with that creative team that was like, we all know we can't create camp. We need to just do what we're doing. Did they try to create camp by casting Patti and then go back on it because they, you know, felt it blew up on their face and that's why they went with Glenn?
I mean, this is just an opinion based on what I've read, because I at this point, I've gone through both Andrew Lloyd Webber's autobiography as well as Patti LuPone's, which I know you love that book.
Patti LuPone's The Bible? Obsessed. I'm obsessed with that book.
Have you listened to it? Have you listened to her read the audiobook?
The audiobook, which is the greatest performance ever given of all time.
I think it might be her best performance.
It is. I own three copies of the actual book. I own three physical copies. And then I send the audiobook to basically anyone who I come in touch with who hasn't. Because there was a time when the audiobook didn't exist. The audiobook came later. She did the. Okay. The book came out first. So I read the hard copy first. But the audiobook, she gives. I mean, it's a performance of a lifetime. She doesn't read that audiobook. Yep. She performs that audiobook. And the Sunset Boulevard chapter.
Two.
Oh, right.
Sunset Boulevard part one and part two.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Part one and part two that's the 11 o'clock number of that book, is all of that.
Absolutely. So you go through Patti's book and you get all of that. And then I heard that Andrew Lloyd Webber's book was coming out. I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to see what his version of this whole story is. Yeah. And his stops at Phantom. So you don't even get the whole Sunset Boulevard thing. And I mean, not to call him out, but I'm calling him out here. It goes right along with everything that she complained about, which is that nobody throughout all of the drama surrounding the casting of Sunset Boulevard was willing to take responsibility for what happened. Nobody was accountable.
Right.
The director wasn't. The designers weren't. The producers were blaming other producers. Nobody was willing to take responsibility.
Yeah.
Let's get into it, though. Let's talk about this. So Andrew Lloyd Webber finishes writing the show. Whenever he finishes writing a show, he premieres it at his Sidmonton Festival, because he has this like whole Downton Abbey type, I don't know, commune that he lives on. And there's an old chapel on the property that he has renovated into a theater. And so every year he has this music festival. And one year after Sunset Boulevard had been written, he decided to do like a reading of the show and debut it at the Sidmonton Festival. He handpicks Patti LuPone, who had, of course, starred as Eva Perón in Evita, to come to London and read the role of Norma. She didn't have to be off book, but she was. Like, it was a full performance. And at the end of it, everybody's, you know, raving about it. Everyone's raving about her. He goes up to her and says, name your price. You're Norma. And she's thrilled. So, like, this is going to be an iconic thing for her. And her people immediately go into negotiations with Really Useful, which is his production company, to get all of the contractual stuff underway. The minute that they start going into these negotiations, stories from the press keep popping up about how Meryl Streep is pissed that Patti LuPone is playing the role of Norma Desmond.
But wait, wasn't Meryl Streep at the reading?
She was at the reading, and according to Patti, they had a wonderful conversation afterward.
Right.
And Meryl, like, gave her the thumbs up.
Patti,
it's one of Patti's favorite things to talk about in the book.
She loves to talk about how she's friends with Meryl Streep. She loves how they're neighbors. It's one of her favorite things to talk about. Meryl's never mentioned it, but Patti talks about them being great friends all the time. On one of her albums, she mentions it. She's obsessed with people knowing she's friends with Meryl Streep. It's a very weird name-droppy thing she does. And then Meryl is like, Patti who? I love Patti LaBelle, is what Meryl Streep is often quoted saying.
So once again, Meryl seems to be totally fine with it. And yet all of these stories keep coming up about this drama. And Patti's like, where is this coming from? And then it turns out that she keeps hearing from her people that the negotiations are not going well. And that Really Useful Group is saying things like, well, you know, she can be replaced. So they start like putting it together that maybe really useful is putting out these stories to try and strengthen their side of the negotiation deals. And she's like, well, that's weird.
Of course,
no one has been accountable for that, but that's kind of what she was getting, because no matter who she talked to, she didn't know where all of these rumors were coming from. They finally decide on the contract, and very specifically in her contract, it says that she will be debuting the role of Norma Desmond in London and then will be taking it to Broadway.
Right.
That's very specifically in her contract.
Ask Patty, she's getting ready to show you. She's got it scanned, ready to show you at any time. She keeps it in her purse. She's got the receipts at all times.
It's laminated on both sides.
It's her phone. It's her iPhone cover now. She just has it as her iPhone cover.
Oh my gosh, Patty LuPone, please have an iPhone cover that's your contract from Sunset Boulevard. So, by the way, like, I want to say that what happened to Patty LuPone is atrocious. And she says to this day that it is the worst experience she's ever had in the theater. Yeah. So we're making light of it, but truly, she was really taken advantage of. So she packs for London, right? Because now they're going into full rehearsals. She sends all of her trunks to London right before she like leaves to go to the airport. She hears that Barbara Streisand has recorded her two big songs in Sunset Boulevard, With One Look and As If We Never Said Goodbye, that they're on her new album, and
which
they have
cannot be overstated. Anyone listening to this already knows this, I'm sure, but it cannot be overstated how much the entire show is built around these two numbers. Like,
right,
the entire show, almost every other number echoes at least one of these numbers. These two numbers are the centerpieces of the entire show.
Yeah.
Huge.
Even though she's meant to debut this role, everyone will have heard Barbara Streisand singing it months before she ever steps on stage.
Right. Sung in the voice of a woman who most people find mm-hmm. perfect for this kind of material. To right. even just say, we think these numbers are so good, Barbara Streisand is recording them. Just that statement in the mm-hmm. 90s? Are you kidding me? Yeah.
No, you're exactly right. And I think that Patti LuPone felt like, well, if you want her to be debuting this music, you should have got her to do the show.
Right.
And I totally get that.
Which in hindsight is exactly what should have happened. But that's a whole other podcast.
That's a whole other story. They go back into negotiations. And they iron out a few more things before she goes to London. Now she goes to London and she's starting to rehearse the show. From what I understand, they more than anything did not want to create the Carol Burnett show.
Right.
Right. Because at this point, the character of Norma Desmond had turned into a parody of the character of Norma Desmond.
Right.
And so they were trying to, I think, like we said, take it very serious. In the middle of those rehearsals, it is announced that there will be an LA production of Sunset Boulevard that will open after London opens. She's like, okay, that's interesting. And then it is announced that Glenn Close will be playing the role of Norma Desmond in Los Angeles.
Which is fascinating because she wasn't in the conversation.
She was never in the conversation.
Right.
But when you look back at it, like I said, the writer of the stage version of Sunset Boulevard, Christopher Hampton, who did Les Liaisons Dangereuses, the star of that film was Glenn Close. It's
right.
the film that won him an Academy Award. She was nominated for an Academy Award. There is already a relationship for this type of writing.
And also Glenn Close
it seems like a no-brainer.
It's also important to state at the beginning of this drama, Glenn Close is notoriously likable. Glenn Close is notoriously easy to work with. Lovely,
really
charming, a go-get. People love Glenn Close. Patti LuPone is notoriously different than that. Patti LuPone comes in with when you hire Patti LuPone, you know what you get and the cost you get it at. You know that with mm-hmm. Patti. So what I imagine is when you say that about, and it's like, maybe I'm making up a story, I very possibly am, but you imagine Patty's like mm-hmm. in negotiations, maybe a few tense moments, and you have Christopher Hampton saying, you know who'd be great in this role.
Mm.
Just saying, and you wouldn't have to deal with any of this. My friend, Glenn. Yeah. It's, I mean, there's nothing stronger for an actor than someone on the creative team who wishes they were working with somebody else. I mean, that's like,
wow.
If you're in a day-to-day and your struggle is with an actress and you're like, we could solve this problem by putting this movie star who has
bankable
a musical
movie
theater
star,
background.
Multi-Academy Award nominations.
Mm-hmm.
And this lights a fire in the early 90s. Now, all of a sudden, we've gone from Meryl Streep versus Patti LuPone to Glenn Close versus Patti LuPone. And all of the rumors start surfacing about who's going to take it to Broadway. And Patti's like, why are we even discussing this? It's in my contract. I'm the one taking it to Broadway.
Right.
And yet the rumor mill continues and she can't do anything about it. They open Sunset Boulevard in London. And I think that this is a good opportunity for me to share the three things that I learned about Andrew Lloyd Webber through his autobiography. Number one, he's obsessed with architecture. Number two, he's obsessed with time signatures. And number three, he's obsessed with bad reviews.
Yes.
He remembers everything that anyone ever wrote about him and takes it very, very personally. And when Sunset Boulevard opens up in London, it has an okay response. It definitely has a lot of people lining up around the block to see it. But the reviews for Patti are not kind.
Yeah.
In fact, what's really unfair is that in some of those reviews, Barbara Streisand is mentioned and so is Glenn Close.
Mm-hmm.
So she was her premiere in this role was already being compared to people who hadn't even played the role.
Right.
And that feels incredibly unfair. And the question then becomes, like, how do you avoid that? Why was everybody so obsessed with this drama of who should play Norma Desmond?
Even to this day, Ben Brantley does it sometimes. When people name check other people's performances in a review, I'm such a show queen that I'm like, why is that not illegal? That should be illegal. Where is the ethics of that? Because what you're doing is you're telling people to compare a live performance, a live human performance, to your imagination.
To your imagination.
Which is impossible. Like, the Norma Desmond of my imagination flies. She's got, I mean, the Norma Desmond
of mine. She
hovers.
She doesn't climb the stairs. She just descends.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. My imagination of how I'm supposed to feel with Norma Desmond, it's not attainable. And so you start comparing a real performance to something, ugh, it's so gross. It's so gross.
It's gross. And I feel so bad for Patti, who, in all honesty, keeps her head down and keeps performing.
Yeah.
Until she's in her dressing room getting ready to go on as Norma Desmond. And she is told that an article has just come out by Liz Smith, who writes for the New York Post.
Yeah.
New York something, who's, you know, like a theater columnist, that Glenn Close is going to be taking Sunset Boulevard to Broadway. She did not find out from the producers, from the creative staff, from her agent. She found out because a columnist broke the story. And this is right before she's about to go on for the role that she is contracted to be bringing to Broadway. And according to Miss LuPone, she grabs a floor lamp and starts swinging and destroys pretty much everything in her dressing room. She's screaming and people are coming in to try and calm her down. She throws open the window and just tosses out the lamp from like the second story window and sends on the understudy.
I've heard that story so many times and I think about that story so much. This is the first time it's ever occurred to me to ask, did anyone get that floor lamp? Where is that? Some queen must have known history was happening. And the West End of London was like, I'm taking this fucking floor.
Some chorus boy's like, put it in my car.
Isn't that floor lamp out there somewhere? This is what I'll do the rest of the day, is try to track down that floor lamp.
Oh my gosh. Now, I know that she didn't go on, and I don't blame her, but don't you kind of wish that she had?
Oh, my God. Can you imagine that performance?
then it wouldn't have been boring.
Right, exactly. I talk a lot about my gay time machine, and like that's the kind of thing that I would get in my gay time machine to go see. And even like her first performance back after all of this, I bet was incredible. Yeah. Because she does. She goes Absolutely. Back. You haven't said, sorry, spoiler alert, but she does. Yeah. She goes back.
Yeah, she, you know, she takes her vacation days, which she is completely able to do for whatever reason. And then her people tell her, look, you've got to finish out your contract, because if you don't, if you break your contract, then they won't have to pay you as much money as they need to for breaking your contract.
Right.
And so, like a trooper, man, she goes back into the show and says that she actually like turned up the volume even more so in her performance. And she finishes out her contract, which I can only imagine what that was like. All while everybody's raving about Glenn's performance in Los Angeles and can't wait for her to bring it to New York.
Which, let's talk about that for 1 second, because you and I both do theater in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I've never done theater in London, but I do know that the London press to this day is still, you know, they're in many ways the hardest theater press to break through.
Thorny, to say the least.
And the Los Angeles press, love them to death, is slightly easier to impress in the theater. Just culturally speaking. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that also there is a very romantic appeal to film star Glenn Close makes good that is very appealing to the PR machine that is Hollywood, which will always trump the New York PR machine.
Theater,
you know what I mean?
And the London press has never really been that impressed with Patti LuPone.
That's because in their eyes, Patti LuPone stole Evita from Elaine Page. So you have...
Oh, of course, of
you
course.
Have that, you have that Elaine Page created Eva Peron, and then... Oh, like, well, we're going to use this American actress. And Patty comes in and gets and becomes the world's Evita. So, you know, it's you go, ooh, there's some karma there, I guess. Although, let's be honest, I love Elaine Page. Elaine Page is not the actress that any of these other women we're talking about are. I adore Elaine Page. Love her, love her, love her. Loved her in Follies. She's amazing. And she vocally, I mean, please, she has an entire Queen album. Yeah. Oh, an album and a Queen album. She's the iconic.
She has both.
Yeah, I love her. But she's not the actress.
It also is interesting, you know, Andrew Lloyd Webber is kind of notorious about what keys his shows and his songs are being sung in and not changing them, right?
Yeah.
Every Christine has to do Christine exactly as it is. And, you know, same with Superstar. You know, it's like, who are we going to get to sing Gethsemane? And then Sunset Boulevard comes around, and he writes these arias, right, for Norma Desmond.
Yes.
That Barbara Streisand recorded.
That's a good word.
That Patti LuPone sings the crap out of.
Yeah.
And I went back and looked at her reviews, and everyone said that Patti LuPone is talented, that she sings her face off, but that she isn't Norma Desmond, that she was miscast, that it's not about skill set, it's just about who these people are. And then Glenn comes along and does Norma Desmond, and they fully lower the keys. It's I've never heard of another Andrew Lloyd Webber type situation where that is the case. Same thing with Evita. Evita is almost impossible to sing, but they certainly haven't ever changed the keys. They just make the girl do it until she's hoarse.
Yeah, they maybe get a matinee Eva if you're lucky.
Right.
No, 100%.
And that being said, I like Glenn's interpretation a lot. I think she sounds great.
This is the problem. This is the thing that got created by the whole press kerfuffle, is we were almost given no choice but to weigh in on this. There's sort of no option other than to sort of go, okay, if you're seeing one, you're thinking about the other. No matter how wonderful your Joe Gillis is, no matter how incredible your Max is, at the end of the day, you're sort of critiquing almost a cabaret performance, because... Mm. The only real meat and potatoes of the show is all on Norma. And it leaves you the opportunity to go, well, I like the way Glenn acts this. I like the way Patty sings this. I wish I could see Barbara perform this. No one can win, because there's, by the time you see whatever Norma Desmond you see, which did you see the tour when it first came?
I saw the tour with Petula Clark.
Same. Me too.
And I have very specific opinions. I was like, I thought she was like Mrs. Santa Claus. Like she's very tiny, and when she moves, she kind of just like, she bops up and down a little bit.
Yeah, she's a British pop star. She's very like, that's so true. So that's the one I saw too, Gamage Auditorium, Tempe, Arizona.
Sounded fantastic.
But when I watch Petula Clark, I sit in Gamma Auditorium. I'm the queen who knows everything about everything that's happened. So by the time I see Petula Clark, I'm watching Petula Clark through the scope of knowing Glenn's album, knowing Patty's album, knowing the clips I've seen on the Rosie O'Donnell show, knowing that Faye Dunaway came in and did this thing, knowing that Betty Buckley did it in London and Elaine Page eventually did it. And then there's the Linda Balgord tour that went out that was too much money. And then there's all this stuff. By the time I see it, I'm seeing like a night of 100 Normas, you know, that come down that stairs. All of them are wrapped up into this one thing. And there's almost not enough around it to grab onto anything else other than like Petula Clark sings the songs of Norma Desmond. Like that's sort of what you're left with.
You are exactly right. This is so true. And I had never considered it. But when you talk about stage adaptations of movies into musicals, you're always comparing musical to movie.
Yeah.
You're saying like what they got right, what they're missing. With Sunset Boulevard, all we talk about is who's playing Norma.
Right. There's nothing else to talk about.
Okay, I want to go through the show, but before we do, really fast. So Glenn takes it to Broadway. She gets raves. Patty sues, really useful for breaking her contract, and I think gets quite a bit of money, as she deserves. Andrew Lloyd Webber never talks to her in person about this. He sends her a letter that says something like, I'm sorry that this has gone so ugly. I have a great idea, though. Once Glenn takes the show to Broadway, why don't you take over the LA company? And Patty's like, are you serious?
The nerve.
Are you kidding me?
The nerve.
The nerve. So she obviously turns it down. So now they need to find somebody else to take over LA. And who do they find but someone who's even more notorious? Faye freaking Dunaway.
I love the idea of being like, oh, God, this Norma Desmond casting has just been a nightmare. I need a break. We need someone in the LA company who's just gonna make it. Well, we can focus on New York. Someone will keep the ticket sales up. And someone says, you know who we need? You know who's great? Who's just easy? Faye Dunaway. Literally the most
said
difficult.
No one ever.
Said no one ever. I'm going to tell you something. Hiring Faye Dunaway has never been a good idea. Ever. Even when it was a bad idea. Even Bonnie and Clyde, it was a bad idea. I still feel like I daily pay the price for the life of Faye Dunaway. It's not fair. She says,
take it very personally.
But then again, it's probably the best thing that ever happened to me. Because
do you remember that? Oh, go ahead.
Are you going to talk
Why
about
was it the
press
best
conference?
Thing that ever happened to you?
Are you going to talk about the press conference she gave on her lawn?
I'm sorry, what?
So when she got fired, so Faye Dunaway, spoiler alert.
Okay, so she goes into rehearsals and they promptly fire her because they say she can't sing. And she's
so
like,
bad.
You hired me with this voice.
Right. At this point, the press knows that they get a lot of traction out of covering Norma Desmond casting. So it was like Entertainment Tonight. It was like major, major news, this Faye Dunaway being fired. So Faye Dunaway, the day after she's fired, holds a press conference in her front yard.
This is bonkers.
She sits on the lawn for the press conference. She sits like she's having a picnic and gives this speech where she says many, many, many things. But she said one of the things she says is, I auditioned for Mr. Lloyd Webber. In my range, I performed. In my range, he knew my range when he hired me. And firing me is, I'm paraphrasing, but you get it. And firing me is one of my favorite quotes of all time, a capricious act by a capricious man.
Oh my gosh.
It's so good. It's so Norma Desmond. I mean, it's like the finale of Sunset. It's so Norma Desmond.
That is what's so crazy about this, though, is that, you know, you talk about the original film being so meta that you can't really tell what's real Hollywood and what's not. This whole experience, like, takes that to a whole other level.
Yeah.
Patti LuPone got Norma Desmond while playing Norma Desmond.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I wrote a short play that has never seen the light of day, but it all takes place the day that Faye Dunaway is fired in a lair underneath the Majestic Theater where Sarah Brightman lives. You only get admitted to this special lair underneath the Majestic, which is where Phantom of the Opera is, if you have played Norma Desmond, Grisabella, Christine, or Eva Perón. And so it's a convention of these women saying, what do? We have a problem in our ranks, and it's this Faye Dunaway situation.
Look, here's the thing. I've never been a huge fan of fringe festivals. However, I really want it to come back just so you can produce this.
You're right. Maybe it's a solo show. Maybe that's the way to do it. I don't know. But I do think the, like, are you kidding me of it all?
No, seriously. It's one of the craziest things in theater history, which is, I think, one of the reasons why I was so excited to cover the show. Because, like, talking about it, you actually get, like, enjoyment out of talking about it. And I know that sounds
trite
and horrible, but it's the fact. Speaking of, did you know that Gloria Swanson tried to create a musical of Sunset Boulevard?
I've heard I don't know anything about it.
At some point, she had her partner, like, started writing songs, and they created a musical version of Sunset Boulevard. I can't believe I didn't bring this up, that she was going to direct. And she even performed a song of it on, like, on one of those variety shows. Which one was it? Steve Allen or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
And
I have to see that.
Of course it doesn't go anywhere because Hollywood is allergic to female directors. And But, like, talk about meta. Norma Desmond is trying to create a musical about Norma Desmond that won't get produced because she's no longer relevant. Okay, we've been talking so long, but I'm having a great time. The musical opens in 1994 in New York. Sunset Boulevard is one of two, count them, two new musicals that season.
Oh, that's right.
It's crazy. So when the Tony Awards nominations are announced, there are two musicals up for Best New Musical. One is Sunset Boulevard. The other is Smokey Joe's Cafe, which is a review of songs,
right,
which means that Sunset Boulevard has no competition for Best Book or Score.
How did that happen? Why did that happen?
It's crazy. And it really does mark the end of this quote-unquote British wave of musicals.
Right.
Because Sunset Boulevard is incredibly expensive. It has this enormous ornate set that is just absolutely gorgeous, but it's too expensive to run. And the year after, Sunset Boulevard wins the Tony for Best New Musical in all of its opulence and drama. The next year, it's Rent.
Right.
The end of these huge, overblown productions is kind of marked by Sunset Boulevard.
And then what survives later is sort of this combination. You could almost argue that a combination of Sunset Boulevard and Smokey Joe's is what sort of comes in to create the jukebox, which is the only thing that can compete with the contemporary musical.
Right. That's a very fair and valid point. So Sunset Boulevard wins all of the Tony Awards that it basically has no competition for. And loses to the ones that Showboat takes. The big Hal Prince revival of Showboat was also right. That season, and very lauded and adored. But Sunset Boulevard is a quote-unquote hit. It runs for almost 3 years, but it is one of the biggest financial flops in musical theater history.
Right.
This show is what coined the term a hit flop.
Yeah.
Meaning that it ran for 3 years. Everybody knows it. It made a huge cultural footprint, and yet lost so much money, probably in many cases because of all of the lawsuits that it received from women they fired.
Yeah, I'd like to think that in addition to Patti LuPone's phone case, that's her Sunset contract, she has a pool raft that is just a printing of all the Sunset grosses and all the losses as she just lounges in her swimming pool that she calls her Andrew Lloyd Webber Memorial Swimming Pool, I think, or whatever she calls it. She names it after him because she bought it with her Sunset money.
That's hilarious. Oh my gosh, I love her. That's fantastic. All right, that's all of the drama. Oh, except that then Glenn Close does the 2017 revival, which is very pared down, very skeletal. It really focuses on the Andrew Lloyd Webber orchestrations, which I think are, look, there's not a composer out there in the theater who knows an orchestra better than Andrew Lloyd Webber. The orchestrations for Sunset Boulevard are glorious. So they had like this 40-piece orchestra on stage, and they get Glenn to come and reprise her role. When she agrees to do it, she has a couple of demands, one of which is that they need to use the monkey that they had in the...
Oh, the monkey. Like the prop of the monkey?
Yeah, like the monkey prop. Which is important. And she had like this really deep connection to it. So she wanted it. and the producers are like stressed out trying to find the monkey. So like, where is this original monkey? And then she hits reply all. There's just one sentence and it's, "I have the monkey."
Oh my God, that's so good. It's like the gayest ransom note of all time. Oh my God.
And so they used her, they used her monkey. She apparently had it. So there you go. There's a fun little quote from the 2017 revival. All right, let's talk through the show. It starts out with a score that really evokes a film noir type feeling. Definitely. Like that orchestra starts playing and I immediately see the world in black and white.
Yes, yes, totally. I completely agree.
After this little overture, it gives way to a prologue, and we meet our protagonist, Joe Gillis, who's kind of an anti-hero. He's a screenwriter in Hollywood, and he is narrating the story, telling us that a murder has been reported at one of those crazy mansions up on Sunset, and that everybody, you know, all of the media is going to be covering this, but if you want the real story, you came to the right spot. So then he takes us back 6 weeks, and we start seeing, you know, what happened leading up to this murder. Way to go, Andrew Lloyd Webber, for writing what I think is probably the best song about Hollywood in a musical, which is Let's Have Lunch.
I love Let's Have Lunch.
Right? It's this montage of Joe Gillis walking through one of the big movie studios, talking to everybody, talking to actors, talking to other writers, producers, his agent. And the through line is this, "Hey, miss you, buddy. Let's have lunch."
Yeah.
It's a great, great number. And also kind of is the beginning of the problems with this show, which is that you have two musicals. You have the musical happening at Norma's house, and then you have the musical happening outside of Norma's house. And they don't quite go together. And maybe that's the point, but I think there is a way to make it a little more cohesive.
I agree. It has that like snappy City of Angels feel. You know, it's that very like maybe a little cheesy.
By cheese, do you mean like show busy?
Show busy, or like just like very broad. And so so when you get into the Norma scenes, the audience doesn't feel necessarily taken care of. They don't know what they're supposed to latch onto. Are they supposed to latch on to the camp, or are they supposed to ignore the camp and take it very earnestly? And those songs, the studio stuff, as much as I love them, they don't really set up any clear guideline for the tone isn't cohesive.
Mm. Interesting. So while he's there, he talks to his agent. He's trying to get, you know, one of his scripts made into a movie. He goes to Sheldrake, who's this producer, asks him to look at a script that he did called Bases Loaded. Sheldrake calls his secretary, Betty, to pull any copy that she may have written on the script. And she says, actually, boss, like, I remember that one. It's just not something that's very good. And he says, oh, well, turn around. That's the writer that you just said that in front of. And this is the meet cute between these two people.
Yeah.
Joe, who can't get a movie made, and Betty, who's an aspiring writer and wants to create films of substance and recognizes the talent in Joe and wants him to get back to the reason why he became a writer in the first place.
Right.
Like that is their connection that has started in this moment. She feels bad for calling him out in such a brash way and tries to make it up to him because I don't want to call them bounty hunters, but two guys who he owes a lot of money shows up to the set.
Oh, yeah. He's got like creditor, like some sort of like
debt collector-y
guys. Yeah.
Debt collector. Thank you. That's the right word. Bounty hunter. that was not the right picture to
although
be giving
they are
the
very,
listeners.
Although they are very aggressive for like they aren't.
Yeah.
I mean, my debt collectors just call a lot.
Yeah, fair enough.
They don't,
but they show up to his place of business and are like, we know you don't have any money, so we need to take your car. And she helps him escape. This turns into a car chase,
right,
in which he's driving down Sunset Boulevard and they're trying to follow him and track him down. He pulls into one of the mansions there along the boulevard and hides in an open garage. And then he gets out of the car just in time for someone to say, "You there, why are you so late?" And he gets brought into this big mansion and sees Norma Desmond, who is this opulent but somewhat decrepit woman crying over the dead body of a monkey.
Yes.
And this is our first moment to meet Norma, is that she has lost her best friend who happens to be a monkey. And it seems that in this huge house, in this huge Art Deco house, the only things living there are her, her butler, and this monkey who has passed away. And she thinks that Joe Gillis is an undertaker, is someone who's going to help her bury the monkey. And this gives way to Norma's first song, which is called Surrender. And I think it's gorgeous.
It's so beautiful. As you get older, you appreciate different things. And this song, I definitely was skipping this song when I was a teenager. I was not. I was like, okay, yeah, schmaltz, schmaltz, schmaltz. I now, like, if Surrender's on and then I catch eyes with my dog, it's over. It is over. We're crying for the rest of the day. It's done. It's done. You know, because it paints the picture that she has nothing except for this grand house, Max, and this monkey. So if you only have three things and one dies, that's a huge loss. That's a huge, huge loss. Ugh, it's haunting. And it really is a beautiful song.
It paints Norma in a fragile way. You can tell she's, I think that that is probably the word I would use to describe her most, is fragile. And I think that all of the great screen artists have an element of fragility. And that may be an unfair generalization. But the fact is that if you're going to be acting with a camera that close to you, your emotions are almost always on the surface.
Yeah. You know, it's funny when you say that, what I start thinking of is Renee Zellweger. I think of Renee Zellweger in Judy, which I didn't feel like she was doing a great portrayal of Judy Garland, although what I was watching her do was very, very captivating and very vulnerable and very honest. And you have that's that fragility. That's that, that like you're watching someone like give a performance from the wreckage of their own.
From their inside out, regardless of, you know, whether it's a powerful performance or a scary performance, if you're working from the inside out, there's something incredibly vulnerable about that. And that has consequences, and be praised for it and have fame for it, I think has some serious consequences. And you see that in Norma, and then you see what's happened to her, which has just, you know, she's been forgotten because of the talkie pictures. And so that's just escalated this. So now Joe is like, hey, I'm so sorry about your friend, but you've got the wrong person, which has to be triggering for her. And then he recognizes who she is and says, hey, you used to be Norma Desmond. You used to be big. And she says,
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
These lines.
It's perfect.
They're so perfect. And is such a great line leading into a song, which is her first big moment called With One Look.
Her first
great
aria,
song.
As you
her first
very
aria.
Very smartly
exactly.
called it. And it's so beautiful. With One Look is such a good song. It's like... he made such a choice. This could have been, I am big. It's the pictures that got small. Clear the decks, clear the tracks. Oh. It could have been, everything's coming up roses, you know? Like it could have been, if he did that, everyone would go, okay, yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah, big number. This is her big number, her ballads in act two. This is her big I want song or whatever. Instead, he says, no, let's turn it on its head and be really vulnerable. And I'm going to tell you the secret of what I do as an actress. I'm going to tell you how much I believe in myself, no matter what you have to say. I'm going to stand in my vulnerability and tell you what I am best at in the world, which is with one look, I can break your heart. And it's like, oh, that is that ability to take that choice, that structural choice. I can't applaud him
enough
for that. Yeah, it's very inspired.
Inspired. She tries to kick him out.
I won't stop you 1,000 times, but I do want to say one thing.
Yeah, no.
At the end of With One Look, she then, her first line of dialogue after then With One Look is, now go.
Now go.
Which is a perfect example of where the audience doesn't know where the tone is. I have no confirmation of this, but everything about it seems like something that was built on Patti LuPone. That now go is a Patti LuPone transition out of a number. She knows she nailed it. Now go. I don't think Glenn Close would organically create that moment. I think she fills that moment because she's given it. That's a moment that feels like camp. There's an argument for that she shifts out of her vulnerability and it's a defense mechanism. Of course, all that stuff is totally valid.
Of course, it works.
But it is that tone shift that's like, it's jarring. You've built up this vulnerability for me, for Norma, and now I'm confused again about how I'm supposed to feel about her. I'm confused about where to put my interest. Do I put my interest in watching a creature who's weird, or do I put my interest in caring about a human being who's struggling? It's very difficult.
What, can it be both, though? Because I think so.
I do.
It makes her unpredictable, and that certainly has a payoff. But still, I see what you're saying.
Yes, I do.
Now, when Joe introduced himself and said that he wasn't the funeral guy, he said, you know, he's a writer. So Norma realizes that if she keeps him around, she can have him work on this film that she's creating, which will be her big return to the film industry. And it is a script about the character Salome. Now, Salome is from the New Testament. She's basically the woman who is responsible for the beheading of John the Baptist. Yeah?
Yes, because of her dance of the seven veils or whatever, right?
Yes. So she's very alluring, very beautiful. And now Norma Desmond thinks that she's the perfect person to play this. Joe, being an opportunist, realizes that, you know, the script is probably crap, that it's never going to happen. But he's broke. He has debt collectors who are trying to, take everything from him. So why not?
Mm-hmm. 100%. I relate to Joe here. I relate to Joe's sort of like non-threatening opportunism here. Like I understand that feeling of like, this woman's going to be this crazy anyways. If she's asking me to stay, I might as well stay. It's interesting because it's this turn.
She's getting something out of it. I might as well.
He's an opportunist, but he's not a bad guy. He's just a little lazy and a little entitled and, you know, and opportunistic.
That's cool. What I don't think he realizes, though, is that he's going to become a slave, in many ways.
Right.
He has to live there, and he becomes the new monkey in many ways, her confidant. So the butler, Max, takes him to his room to stay, and Max reveals that he is not just a butler. He used to be married to Norma and was her director. Was the director of all of her best pictures. And now he's kind of been reduced to this butler role because he cares enough about her that he wants to take care of her. Yeah, that fragility probably that he captured so much on camera makes him want to take care of her.
Yeah.
He writes her fan letters every day and pretends to be other people so that she still thinks she has this fan following. From there, the next thing that we see is Joe's first work session with Betty.
Yeah, so this is where I feel like there's a missed opportunity because I think Max and Norma's relationship is so interesting. And and there's so much there about like what he did for her and what she knows he did for her. And yet the agreement is we're going to play our parts, which is that you're lucky to be here and I'm a star and we all live in the orbit of which only one of us can be the center focus. And years ago, we chose that it's me. And then there's Betty and Joe, who Joe's self-confidence is completely in the gutter. He's got no money. Nobody wants anything he has to do. So he's pitching these lousy screenplays just to make a buck. And Betty says, you're better than this. I believe in you. You could be so much more if you would only believe in yourself the way I believe in you. I mean, that's a quartet right there.
That's a great...
Dueling duets right there. It would be so... The mirror would be so wonderful to establish and not to spoon feed it, but like.
No. But it would also create a bridge between these two worlds.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. To show that the same things are happening in these two separate worlds makes it feel like it's a little more synchronistic.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But we don't have that. We have Betty and Joe.
We don't have that, though. We have Betty and Joe, and we don't really care about their romance. It feels
it's
like
weird.
A very, she's, very much side plot.
She's engaged to his good friend.
That's true.
Which is not, that's not on the show's problem. That's a plot from the movie. It's not, it's just a weird, like.
I think it makes Joe's character incredibly complicated. Like I said, he becomes kind of an anti-hero because of, He's mooching off of one woman and possibly stealing the lover of his best friend.
Right.
Norma continues her craziness. Every night she makes him like get dressed up and they go and watch one of her films. This is another, when you were saying like you always skipped Surrender, New Ways to Dream is a song that I completely avoided. And now I really love that song as well.
Yeah, it's good. It's really good. It's beautiful. And it's a great musicalization of the film, that moment, I think, too.
Yes, agreed. Okay, so now it's New Year's. And Betty wants Joe to go to this New Year's party with all the kids and all the artists and everything. And Norma wants Joe to stay with her for their New Year's soiree. And Joe's like, I want to go hang out with my friends. You can't keep me here. I'm not your monkey. I'm going. So he leaves. But then when he's at the party with all of his friends, he receives a phone call from Max saying that Norma has slit her wrists. Mm-hmm. It really is, I think, the moment that Joe can't keep ignoring all of the warning signs. When you're around somebody this eccentric, you can kind of play it off as, oh, that's just that person. Mm-hmm. But now she has taken manipulation to a whole new level by trying to kill herself. And now what do you do? What he does is he runs back to her,
right,
and apologizes and ends up making out with her. Which is just kind of disgusting. And it's this amazing stage picture where she has her wrists like bound with these bandages and he's kissing her and she's like raising her arms with her like spider fingers. It's so creepy and amazing and kind of Nosferatu in a way.
It is Nosferatu. I've never gone to those extremes, of course, but I think, oh, how many Joe Gillises have made out with me because they were afraid of me out-Norma-ing myself. how many times have I been in that? And really, like, those Joe Gillises should have just gone home. They really should have just gone home.
Oh, my. That's amazing. That's your Sunset Boulevard chapter in your book.
Right, exactly. It's a very different. It's a whole other musical.
All right. Act two begins with Joe singing the title song, Sunset Boulevard, while trying to figure out whether what he's doing is right or good or has a future, which we all know the answer is no.
Right.
He's also doing it in the tiniest bathing suit you've ever seen in musical.
Oh, this bathing suit. I forgot. He shows up in this thirst trap of a bathing suit.
Why? It's actually a really interesting song with a lot of emotional undercurrents, and you can't pay attention to anything because he's in this tiny bathing suit.
Absolutely. It's that like late 20s, early 30s leading man tenor body, which is always that like, even though everything about it should be sexy, it almost isn't. Always, no matter what. Like, it's just like, but it's distracting. And where's the mic pack?
You're right. Distracting is the right word. Thank you.
Because then he takes off the bathing suit. Do you remember that? That he takes off.
No.
I had forgotten
this. When did he take off the bathing suit?
I had forgotten this. And to prepare for this, I watched some clips from 2017 and I'd forgotten that in the number, he puts on his robe and then he takes off the bathing suit. So he gives the very, like, the illusion of that he's naked on it, which, of course, like, he's in some sort of brief with his mic pack, of course. But, like...
Yeah, because he didn't... Yeah.
Right. But, like, again, you imagine this straight white male team being like, well, we should probably give the gays something here. We should probably... excuse me, Christopher. I was thinking perhaps Joe could just be in a tiny little bathing suit. Because I don't know if I'm giving the gays everything they want in every scene with Norma, so perhaps they will be happier if I give them just this itty-bitty bathing suit. That's my Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Do you think... That was a great Andrew. There is something really interesting to me about him being a kept person, like a kept boy.
Yeah,
right?
For sure.
And he looks like, and he looks all perfect, and he's sitting at a pool, which is, you know, the epitome of living the Hollywood dream. And yet there's this undercurrent of knowing that it's wrong and not feeling content with it. Mm-hmm. I totally get that. I just wish it was maybe done in a different way.
Yeah, it just feels a little baity.
Great. Now that we've talked about the bathing suit for 20 minutes. Next up, Norma receives a phone call from the studio saying that Cecil B. DeMille wants to see her. Yeah. And she's like, this is it. They've received my script that we've been working on. This is going to be the big return. And what it actually is, however, is they're doing a movie that needs a car, like a vintage car that she owns.
That they saw Max drive on the lot when he dropped off the script.
Thank you. Yes, exactly. And so they want to use the car. So she thinks that she's going because they, you know, they've missed her and they're ready to do this project. But that is not the case at all. They go to set, however, and the moment of her returning is the moment that she has been dreaming of. And it gives us a huge wish fulfillment because we see her live the glory of that in As If We Never Said Goodbye, which I think is 5 times the number that Don't Cry For Me Argentina is.
Agreed.
And that's saying something because Don't Cry For Me Argentina is fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. For all these years, I've admired the fact that there's this moment. She sings this number, right? And I always thought the staging was brilliant, Trevor Nunn's staging of letting everyone watch her sing this song. And in my like novice brain, I always thought, oh, it's great. They let her talk to them. They applaud her at the end after she basically just makes a lap, right? From the director's chair. Mm-hmm. Then she makes her lap around the stage and then back to the director's chair is like the staging that's always been done. And it wasn't until recently that I realized that what they watch is Norma say nothing, live in that moment in captivated silence, take it all in, probably make eye contact with every single person in the room, bring them in, and with one look, she breaks all of their hearts. She does exactly what she promised you she would do in the first act.
Ugh.
We experience it through a song that's written in first person. And it leads into that beautiful musical moment right after that with Cecil B. DeMille, which is actually one of my favorite parts of the whole score. When he realizes, it's almost you see Cecil B. DeMille realize what we all now know, you know, we all say it all the time. And I had a whole podcast about it, about that we dispose of these women once they hit a certain age. It's almost like this is the moment where Cecil goes, oh, God. What do I do? What am I going to do? What have we done to you and the hundreds of other ones? And what am I going to do about it? And you see it's too overwhelming. And he just goes back to work with young actresses. Wow. There's always a young actress right in that, in like a belly dancer costume. Just that whole moment is really quite stunning because so many things are happening that are musicalized. You got to give them all credit for that structure and that creation. It's really, really stunning. And it's Glenn's best, As If We Never Said Goodbye, is Glenn's best Norma moment, I think.
For sure. She did that on the Tony Awards. And if you haven't already seen it, go see it because it's probably one of the best Tony Award performances ever.
Yeah, it's really good.
It's perfection. Okay. Now, after this, everything starts kind of escalating a little bit more. Norma is convinced that Cecil B. DeMille is going to call for her at some other point. And so in the meantime, she's going to get gorgeous and talk to astrologers and make sure and see when the best time it would be
astrologer,
to be filming.
That's one of the best featured ensemble tracks of all time. That astrologer and the therapist, but the astrologer especially, because she has that cape. She does that. What is that line? I can't even remember. It's all visual to me, but she sings that line and she's like the eccentric. And you also are like, oh, you're also like the third cover for Norma. So like you're like ready to go on at any moment.
That's amazing. We also see the relationship between Betty and Joe click up a few notches.
Oh yeah, that's when we have that song.
They're working on their script and then they sing the song called Too Much in Love to Care, which is I think probably one of the most boring songs of the whole score. The most
it's
memorable
so
thing to me
boring.
About Too Much in Love to Care is that I remember in that big old booklet in my double CD case, I'd be following along with the lyrics because the whole libretto is printed in there. And at the end of the song in the libretto, it said in the stage directions, it is obvious that they are about to make love.
Is it?
I mean,
is it obvious?
I guess they just sang the song.
I mean,
I don't know. I just thought that was so specific.
It's obvious that they are about to make love. Well, there's a playable stage direction, kids.
Up for interpretation.
Yeah.
Betty and Joe are in love, and you know what? They're too much in love to care.
They're too much in love. Even if Alice Ripley is playing Betty Schrafer, not necessary.
Thank you. I mean, we had some pretty impressive Betty Shavers between Judy Kuhn and Alice Ripley. Yep. My goodness.
Judy Kuhn.
This all leads to the final scene in which Norma discovers about Betty and feels absolutely betrayed. And it's this—it's a huge confrontation in which Betty comes to the mansion and Joe, in order to protect her, basically breaks up with her and says he wants nothing to do with her. He breaks her heart so that she will leave because he's afraid of for her safety. Betty leaves. He has this whole confrontation with Norma.
Oh, and where Norma says when she thanks him. She thanks him for breaking up with Betty. It's so
pathetic.
Pitiful. Yeah, it's pathetic and pitiful. Yeah. It's just so, she knows he loves this other woman, but he's breaking up with her to be with her. And she accepts it.
She accepts it as like a gift, as though he just brought her flowers.
Ugh, it's so upsetting.
And he says, you know what? No, I don't choose you. I'm leaving.
Right.
And he goes to leave and she grabs a gun and shoots him. And he falls into the pool, which means that the murder that we heard about at the very beginning of the show is actually his own.
Dun, dun, dun!
Yeah. And I will never forget, it's one of my favorite deaths in all of film history, when William Holden gets shot because he's walking. He, like, packs his suitcase and he's walking out and Norma Desmond comes out and shoots him. And it hits him, but he, like, keeps walking. He, like, gets hit and then keeps walking, and then she shoots him again, and then he falls into the pool and just floats there. Oh, it's so good.
Oh, my God. I wish that the listeners could have just seen how well you just recreated William Holden's death. That was such a good William Holden dies in Sunset Boulevard death recreation. That was really...
If I can maybe do it in your Fringe show, I would be really
excited. Yeah, it'll just be a passing through.
Exactly.
Fantastic.
And so now Norma has killed her new monkey, basically. And so she's completely cracked. I mean, she's not Norma anymore. I think it's safe to say she has reached to the place of complete mental breakdown. And the police show up and there are reporters because obviously it's murder involving someone famous.
And Hedda Hopper is there at the scene, which I love. As if Hedda Hopper was like an at the scene reporter. I love that part.
Oh, that is funny. And she and Norma's just like getting ready and she's like not there anymore. And they're trying to figure out how they're going to get her, you know, out of the house. And Max, who, you know, has been with her all this time, realizes that the only way to do it is to feed into the crazy, mm-hmm. that they need to convince her that it is time to shoot this film for her big return. Mm-hmm. And that by luring her to the cameras or to her public or to her dream, that they can get her to the police station.
Yeah.
So.
Ugh, it's devastating.
Yeah, he starts painting the picture of the people are ready and she walks out and there are all these reporters and the police officers and she thinks in her, you know, now completely fantasy mind that these are the people on set and she is filming a movie and
she's Salome.
Yeah, she's Salome. And she's walking to her close up, but truly the close up is her end.
Yeah.
It's the end of Norma Desmond.
And you get the sense in the film and in the show, you get the sense that it really is the end. You get the sense that there's no more Norma. Like you said, Norma's gone and there's no more Norma.
Despite all of the drama and all the camp, it's a very sad story about a kind of creature that we constantly create in our society, mm-hmm. which is someone that we build up to then watch fall down.
Yeah.
And my heart does go out to all the Normas out there or just any of the artists who struggle with confusing their own self-worth with their artistic value. Mm. And it's a really tricky line to toe, for sure.
It is.
I know it is in my life.
Yeah, because to do the business of show business requires more and more sacrifice of self in a lot of ways. And it's that balance of taking care, you know, self-care and being open to that vulnerability. And you know, I've seen many people who I get jealous of their success. And many times you go, at what cost? Two things. That person might be willing to pay a price that I'm not willing to pay, that I know nothing about.
Mm-hmm.
And also something in the universe, whether you know, whatever your faith is or what you believe in a higher power, is something saying, you don't want this. The thing that you think you're going to get from this, you're actually going to get from not having this. And that, you know, rejection is God's protection. And that you look at Norma has so much. She has clearly she has enough wealth to sustain herself. You sort of go, if only Max had spent all that time writing those fan letters at maybe like helping both of them work on acceptance. And you know, the lesson there is wanting more is probably going to get you more, but you may not actually want more.
Yeah.
Now, I'm
No, you're absolutely right. It's like the foundation of scarcity, right?
Yes.
That the opposite of more is not less. The opposite of more is enough.
Ooh. Do you know any of those people? I do. I certainly do. I know some of those people who have had what I deem success beyond all measure. And yet I can see that they don't live in the appreciation of that. They live in the lack of what they have now, or the perception that it was supposed to be something else. Or I'm grateful for examples like that in my life because it helps me remember that no matter what we get in life, each day we just have that day and we have what's in that day. And if we aren't training ourselves to be grateful for what we do have, you can create a monster in yourself.
There's a theater person who I know who has a very successful career and has originated a lot of roles on Broadway. And when trying to express like the congratulations for all of that success, what was given was, well, I don't know what I have to do to get a Tony Award nomination.
Right.
And when I heard that, I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. And then they got nominated for a Tony Award, and then they won a Tony Award. And when I saw them win that Tony Award, I thought, well, I hope you're happy.
Mm-hmm.
But you probably aren't.
Yep, probably aren't.
Because that feeling doesn't get solved by more stuff.
No, no, definitely not.
Ever.
You know, I'm a recovering alcoholic, so I've been sober for 4.5 years, and that's Congrats. Same. It's that same thing. You chase something that you know, we talk in AA about the God-sized hole in yourself that you fill with anything. You know, it can be booze, food, fame is a huge one. I mean, I fame and praise and accolades, like there should be a 12-step program just for that.
Congratulations, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. Yeah, I mean, you know. It's for everybody's. It's in everybody's best interest, really. otherwise, I'm a real Norma. I mean, imagine I'm such a Norma 4.5 years sober. Imagine an unsober version of my Norma Desmond. That's not pretty. That's not pretty. But watch out. I have a zoo full of monkeys.
Oh,
and probably a cage full of Joe Gillis's, to be honest.
Just check the basement. Thank you so much, Ryan, for doing this.
Oh my God, thank you for having me. I've had the best time, and thank you for, I love that you pick musicals for people, and it made me feel very seen that you asked me to do this one. It made me feel very understood.
I'm so grateful. As always, if you have suggestions for musicals that we cover here on A Musical Theater Podcast, you can email me at amusicalpodcast@gmail.com. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at A Musical Podcast for more great content. Like I said earlier, we have a TeePublic store with original designs that capitalize on some of our favorite moments in episodes past and present. I'm pretty sure there's going to be one from this episode, so check that out. And Ryan, how do we follow you and all the things that you're up to? Because you've got your hands in many pots in around town.
Yeah, I mean, the best place is Instagram. I'm Ryan O'Connor, 81, 81 the year I was born. And
woo.
And O'Connor, like Sinead, Sandra Day, Donald, all of Carol, all the O'Connors. O-R, O-C-O-N-N-O-R.
You got some good company there.
I do.
Thank you, everybody, for listening, and be nice to your floor lamps.
Absolutely.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the SUPs. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Suffs celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.